The cable campaign is beyond chutzpah. It's extortion. Small local governments don't have the wherewithal to figure out when they're being duped. That's a comment by Barry Orton in the Wall Street Journal in 1993. 16 years later, can the telecommunications industry still be charged with extortion and duplicity? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
As consumers trying to arrange for phone, video, and internet services, we scramble to keep up with changing technology, misleading advertisements, and confusing monopolies. How do telephone, cable TV, and internet businesses compete for our broadband telecommunications dollars, and why does where we live matter? Joining us is Barry Orton, professor of telecommunications in the Department of Professional Development and Applied Studies in the UW-Madison's Division of Continuing Studies.
Well, Barry, welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having me.
I have a hunch that during this conversation we'll be, or you'll be, defining terms more than a few times. So let's start with the broadest, broadband.
Well, broadband is a generic term that means a fast connection of some sort to either a source of video or a source of audio or the internet or all three. And so it's really a catch-all term that these days means a faster connection than a standard old-fashioned dial-up internet connection.
But isn't old-fashioned dial-up internet connection already like a thing of the past for most people?
Not at all. In the state of Wisconsin, there are quite a few people who are in rural areas or in some cases other areas that don't have sufficient broadband technology available to them. And they are using dial-up. It is not so much a thing of the past. And the issue that we're going to talk about today, I think, is why is it that depending on where you live, you can either access the internet in a very fast and convenient way for some money or access the internet in a somewhat as fast but not so convenient way for lots of money or not access the internet at all in any way beyond a very slow dial-up, no matter what you pay.
Well, let's go to that Wall Street Journal comment that I opened with that you made back in 1993, back when you were talking about the cable campaign, and you used terms like extortion and duplicity.
Yeah, that was a campaign between the cable industry and the consumers, and the cable industry was basically trying to avoid regulation by, in that case, arguing that local and state governments shouldn't regulate it because the marketplace was going to be fine. And that was in light of a 1992 law that the Congress passed because the cable industry was deregulated before that. And in fact, prices were going through the roof and consumers were paying and not having any rights. So the federal government and through the Congress in 92 passed what was then a re-regulation bill, which regulated the cable industry pretty specifically on things like rates and services. And what the cable industry did then was campaign among local governments, who were then my clients, saying, don't use the federal law, let the marketplace control, because everything is just fine. And so that was one of my great achievements, is getting the word chutzpah in the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, the industry wasn't very pleased about that. As that turned out, we had a round of regulation of cable in 93 and 94. And then a very important thing happened for the industry in 94, and that was Congress turned over in 94 with the so-called Newt Gingrich Revolution. And all of a sudden, the Congress became Republican, and re-regulation started getting rolled back as fast as the bureaucracy could do because the new masters of the Federal Communications Commission was the Republican House at that point, and the Republican House wasn't a regulation house. It was a deregulation legislation.
That has to be part of the problem right there, and by problem I mean confusion and maybe a little bit of skullduggery too. When administrations change and the approach to regulation changes back and forth every 4 years, 8 years, 12 years,
whatever
it might be.
Well, it's more frequent than that because in 94 the administration didn't change.
Right.
The administration was still Democratic and had run on this re-regulation in some ways and was, to the best of its ability at the Federal Communications Commission, trying to ratchet up regulation. But at the same time, they knew that their they being the Federal Communications Commission, knew that their economic masters was really the Congress, which funds them, and the Congress was going in an absolutely different direction with the Gingrich revolution. And so the problem, as you say, is we as consumers and these industries we're going to be talking about today are very dependent on the political regulation of those industries, and that happens on a number of levels. It happens state by state, in many cases with public service commissions, and it happens on the federal level when both administrations change or the majority control of Congress changes. So you might have kind of a flip-flop between regulation, deregulation, stimulus, let the marketplace decide every 2 years. And that kind of thing really does make industries nervous about putting their money into particular kinds of developments, and it makes consumers confused as to who's on their side and what their rights are.
It's
and, of course, that changes.
Syncopated regulation. Now, you've used twice now that word rights. The consumers are buying this product.
Right.
What kind of rights do they have, I mean, as purchasers of a product?
And you know what? That very much depends on where they live. Again, they have different rights state by state depending on what the public service commissions of their particular state has decided, which depends on what their state legislatures have decided or their governors. It depends city by city in some cases, where in some cities, for example, a city like Reedsburg, Wisconsin has decided to get into the telecommunications business itself as a utility and provide it for its citizens. Or its neighboring city, which decided not to do that and let the marketplace completely control. And then, of course, it changes drastically year by year or administration by administration on the federal level. So what you have are industries that spend an awful lot of their money on lobbying, on political activity, on creating these so-called grassroots, we call them AstroTurf groups, that are pretend consumer groups that lobby as if there was a real consumer group there and lobby for their masters, which turn out to be a corporation that sponsors them. So the competition in telecommunications happens not only in the marketplace where I get to decide between company A and company B, or cable company A and phone company B both trying to offer me video, but it also is in the state legislature and in the Public Service Commission and the Federal Communication Commission itself, where millions or in some cases billions of dollars are spent on lawyers and lobbyists and these political action groups. If those people who live in Wisconsin probably remember last year and the year before when a group called TV for Us spent all this money on advertising, convincing us the cable companies were evil and corrupt and greedy and the phone companies were wonderful. And legislation gets influenced by that kind of activity. So you have the competition in the marketplace, but you also have the competition in the field of public opinion and then the competition in the decision point of the state and federal governments, which make real economic regulatory decisions as to who can offer what services, where they don't have to offer them, and at what price.
Doesn't the changing technology make this kind of a moving target too?
Absolutely.
I was just thinking how confusing it's become. If you think back in the past where we just had one phone line, nobody had the computer internet access or anything, you just get one phone book. And now we get all these different phone books. You can't even tell which company is sending it. You have companies like SBC becoming AT&T. Sometimes you get ads and you're not even sure which company it used to be.
Right. And you have head-to-head competition now for your telephone business between your cable TV company and your phone company. And between those companies and the companies offering cellular wireless service, which can be a number of other companies all offering different kinds of services. These things start to get blurry. Originally, as you said, Emily, originally we had a phone company. It was easy. Us old people remember landline phones, one phone company, Ma Bell, no choice, very easy decision. Yes, you have a phone or you don't. In the old days, it was you had a party line or you didn't. Then you could get things like caller ID and other kinds of so-called frills, but it was still a phone company or nothing. But then we got technologically more sophisticated and people started going to cell phones, which most of us thought in the old days were never going to make it. And we thought that was kind of a frill and something that only very, very rich people could afford. And now it's almost become – I don't think you'd say it was a necessity, but if you have teenage children in the state of Wisconsin, they'll argue it's a necessity.
Well, what percent of people in Wisconsin or in the country have cell phones now as opposed to landlines?
Well, the balance has tipped to the point where there are more cell lines going to individuals than there are landlines. So I don't know what the current numbers are now, but it's probably close to 60-40 cell versus landline and still growing in the cell – in the wireless side versus the wired side.
Does that make regulation even more complicated?
Yes, it does, because cell phone regulation is largely federal because it's the airwaves, just the same folks who regulate the radio stations we know very well, the Federal Communications Commission. The states don't have very much to say about cell phones. And so you have a layer cake of regulation, and one layer might regulate one thing and another layer might regulate another, but those two things are directly competitive. It is very confusing. It's been a wonderful time for telecommunications attorneys. They do very well. It's a wonderful time for telecommunications lobbyists who have done very well. But we also – it is a good time for consumers, and I think let's take it from the cell phone and the regular phone to the next level. The next level, of course, was cable TV. And that started in rural areas and then moved to suburbs and cities. And it not only showed us more television than we ever could imagine could exist, but then, of course, the cable TV people realized that over that same wire, they could sell this brand new thing which went from zero to 60 miles an hour and seemingly overnight, the internet. And so at one point, we were all grateful to have dial-up internet and we could maybe watch a little picture come in slowly and we could do email. But that didn't last, and we wanted the picture to come in faster, and then we wanted to hear sounds over the internet, and now we're watching movies and little television clips over the internet, and that takes a faster and faster connection. And so the cable people realized they could sell a second product. They could sell the internet through the so-called cable modem. And that same product started to be sold by the phone companies through a package called DSL, Direct Service Line, or Digital Service Line, actually. And so there was competition again for our internet dollars between the original dial-up internet companies like AOL, between them and the cable companies, which sold a faster version of internet, and the phone companies, which sold a somewhat slower version of internet. And so the cable companies started realizing they had a secondary source of revenue and profit, and then they thought about telephone. And so now, these days, we have internet based telephone over the cable company line. We have the same digital internet-based telephone over the telephone line, which now carries us video as well. And so we have the phone companies and the cable companies competing head-to-head on three basic kinds of services. Complicating that, we have satellite companies who sell video first and now internet and soon phone. And so we have a myriad of companies regulated very differently and offering services that might be reasonably cheap, reasonably priced, or very highly priced, or not available at all, again, depending on where you live.
And do you think it's good that there's all these different companies and options out there?
Well, it is good for the idea that there's competition, and competition is always good in terms of prices and services if there is true marketplace competition, if the companies can compete head-to-head for the same people's money, if they are evaluated fairly, and if they are regulated similarly. But when Company A is regulated only by a state and Company B is only regulated by the federal government and Company C isn't regulated at all, then it gets confusing. So we have in the state of Wisconsin, we had a history of kind of basic regulation protecting consumers in everything. And that's through the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection here in Wisconsin. And they have some very general rules about why you can't and how you can't cheat consumers. And those rules apply to everybody, whether you're a phone company, a cable company, or selling roofing. But then there are some specific rules for phone companies that are done through the Public Service Commission, and now some more specific rules for cable companies done through the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. In general, you can say this. It's a buyer beware system because your protections are fairly minimal, and they only usually kick in after you have a complaint. And you usually have a complaint after something has gone wrong. Either the price has gone too high, or you can't get out of a contract, or a service wasn't delivered. And so those complaints, when they happen, start happening in good numbers. And there are a significant number of complaints now about telecommunication services, particularly some of the fly-by-night phone companies, and to the cable companies, particularly over pricing, and now also complaints about cell phones, particularly cell phone contracts people have trouble getting out of. When you get a new improved cell phone, you might have to pay off your old company to get out of your contract for your old phone. So it's kind of a Wild West situation. And people really have to beware of the contracts they sign and the very fine print that goes on for pages and pages, giving the rights mostly to the company that's providing something. And in general, if they complain to the state or they complain to the federal government, they can say that they've complained. They can say they've spent the time calling, or they put a stamp on an envelope and they sent it, and those complaints get counted. Do they get acted upon? Not usually, but they get counted.
It gets more complicated for the consumer, doesn't it, when you start bundling things and it's maybe some apples and oranges over here and some peaches and pears with this company
comparison. That's absolutely correct. Let's take the simple kinds of comparisons that people have to make now between the company that's offering you a bundled triple play package of video, telephone, and internet. And to make it simple, because in this state you're seeing a lot of that competition between AT&T, which is offering a product called UVerse, which is a video package, bundled with a phone package, and bundled with a high-speed internet package of some sort. And, of course, that whole thing is being labeled broadband. On the other side, you have cable companies, and the two big ones in this state are Charter and Time Warner. Time Warner in the Milwaukee and Green Bay area is mostly the eastern part of the state, and Charter in most of the rest of the state. But there are packets of other companies as well. But for those customers who are looking to bundle that way and looking to save money, you see that they are advertised for a particular price and particular speed of internet and a particular number of channels, and that all varies greatly depending on how long the contract lasts, how long the introductory price lasts, how long the channels that you're buying stay in business, how long the internet package you're using, how well that works with your computer. All those kinds of things are variable. And so the buyer really has to make some very tough decisions about the cost of this bundle of services and how long that cost will last, because once the contractual obligation of the introductory price is over, most, if not all, of that stuff is completely unregulated. So they could theoretically double the price in a month, and you have no real recourse once that contract period, the contractual price, is ended. And that's usually a six-month kind of introductory period. So no longer does cities regulate cable, for example. No longer does the state regulate cable in any real way. And so the price theoretically could go up every year, and in cases of many of these systems, it has.
Didn't you say, though, that a city like Reedsburg has become a supplier? So would they not regulate?
Well, they're not regulated. They're not allowed to regulate by law, but they're competing. What the city of Reedsburg has done is it's set up a municipal utility, just like a lot of municipal utilities that provide power in this state. For example, in Columbus, Wisconsin, you buy your electric power from the Columbus utility, which is run primarily by the city of Columbus. And so it's a public entity, but you can't buy power from anybody else in Columbus. But in Reedsburg, you can buy your video and your phone and your internet from AT&T in certain parts of town, from Charter in most of the rest of parts of town, or from the Reedsburg utility. So the real benefit of that is, one, it provides head-to-head competition, which, again, would keep prices lower and service better. But it also, and this is my point that happens over and over in this discussion, it also means that there aren't people in the city of Reedsburg who aren't served at all. The current law worries me about a few things. One, it worries me because people outside of the cities don't get this kind of robust service or competition, and in some cases don't have competition at all, and in some cases don't have the opportunity to have high-speed internet at all. They're stuck with dial-up. In addition, the new state law that the legislature passed 2 years ago that deregulated cable from local control allows, theoretically anyway, the company said they wouldn't do this, but theoretically there's no law against it. They could withdraw service from, for example, the poorer areas in the middle of the city of Milwaukee or the downtown area of a city like Columbus or Reedsburg.
On the grounds that they're not profitable enough?
On the grounds that those particular blocks or those particular areas or don't have enough people or are too hard to reach or those people don't pay their bills well enough. And so there could be what I call broadband brownfields within cities.
And that's legal?
That would be legal.
I mean, I would think to have a company able to say, oh, you know, this area of inner city Milwaukee, we can't make a good enough profit off that, so we won't serve it. You would think that would be
– I thought that was illegal like in the insurance business.
Well, it is in the insurance business. It's illegal in certain housing and loan applications. In some finances, it's illegal. It's called redlining.
Right.
But in telecommunications, at this point, it is not illegal. There are some provisions in the law that encourage the companies to serve everybody, but it doesn't say they have to, and there's no government body that forces them to. The problem would be this, and I'm kind of projecting here. And again, you're in the same boat if you're in the downtown or the lower socioeconomic portions of the city of Milwaukee as you are in the very rural areas of the state. There's only one wire or two wires going by your house. Well, three really. There's power, there's phone, and sometimes there's cable. But the cable wire doesn't go outside of the city limits in a rural city. And the cable wire does go past every city street in the city of Milwaukee and every city in Wisconsin because the city of Milwaukee or the city of Madison used to require it as part of their cable franchise. Those cable franchises were eliminated last year or 2 years ago by the state deregulation law, the so-called video competition law. And so theoretically, and again, this is theoretically right now. I don't have any facts that say this is on the case, but it could be. Time Warner could decide that where its cable wires went in certain streets of Milwaukee, it no longer would offer the broadband alternative. It would offer plain vanilla cable, because that sells very well all over the city of Milwaukee, but it would no longer offer, for example, the additional high-speed, it's called Roadrunner in Milwaukee, the additional high-speed internet service or the phone service that goes to it. And then the other part of this is AT&T, which is developing and building its system all around the Milwaukee area, could very well decide, as its original maps showed, it was going to have a donut pattern in the city of Milwaukee, and it was going to serve a ring, but it wasn't going to serve the center of the donut. It wasn't going to build into the center because it didn't have to by law. And its economic projections of phone use showed that there were certain neighborhoods, and even within certain neighborhoods, certain blocks that weren't going to get that enhanced service. They weren't going to invest in building that enhanced service in those areas, just as they weren't and didn't invest in the very rural areas for pretty much the same reason. The economic viability, as far as their projections are concerned, didn't make it worthwhile. And there was no law, like there was with phone, saying you serve the state, you serve everyone in the state. You take that phone line past that last few customers. So that's a real concern for me because I think there's an equity issue involved in terms of the access to information that's become really necessary for economic activity and for educational activity in this state. Emily knows more than almost anybody how many people are now starting doing distance education or doing their education via the internet. You know that how many people are doing education via radio. That was one of the reasons that the University of Wisconsin got into radio in the first place.
Extension idea. Mm-hmm.
We didn't do it to play music so much as really extend education. Well, in the early days, say in the 1920s, that radio didn't get into those barns in the very rural areas because they didn't have electricity. The electricity and the phone only got there in the 1930s when the New Deal's Rural Electrification Act put federal dollars into extending the wires to the rural areas so that the farms could have electricity, so that people could listen to the radio and the cows could listen to the radio and they could have light bulbs in the barns, all those kinds of things, which became enormous productivity engines.
So there's somebody espousing that concept for broadband service, let the federal government fill the donut?
That's correct. In the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the so-called stimulus bill, there was allocated a total of, let's see if I've got it right, $7.2 billion to extend broadband to underserved and unserved areas in rural and in some cases cities, but mostly rural. And that money was split between the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Commerce. And the Department of Agriculture had $2.5 billion, and the Department of Commerce got $4.7 billion to extend to companies, to localities, to organizations that would help extend broadband to unserved areas. And the theory was the same as the Rural Electrification Act, that we would extend these technologies, which are necessary to have an information-based business in your home, which are necessary to have your kids do research on the internet from home. We would extend those to rural areas and in some cases to underserved city areas as well.
Problem solved?
No.
We'll find out why not when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Barry Orton, and we are talking about how telephone, cable TV, and internet businesses compete for our broadband telecommunications dollars. You were saying, Barry, that the stimulus package had, what it was, $7-point-something billion dollars set aside to help get more access to rural
right.
areas. But you said this is not going to be enough. Why
it's not going to be anywhere near enough money because there are enormous amounts of people who are underserved. And the definition of underserved is kind of a moving target. We used to think 5 and 8 years ago that it would be great if we could get something a little better than dial-up for the rural folks. But now it turns out that people who are using these technologies find more and more things to put on them, and it needs more and more bandwidth faster. So the pipes need to get bigger and bigger as we move along. So whether it's the ability to upload the video you've just shot of your farm to a buyer of your goods, or the ability to get online and let people know what you're doing, whether you're an information-based business or a standard bricks-and-mortar kind of business, whether it's a farm or a store, it turns out that more and more you need bandwidth to keep track of your competitors. You need bandwidth to reach your customers. You need bandwidth to do the kind of research and development that you need to keep your productivity competitive. And all those things happen kind of at the same pace as our computers developed, which means they get faster, they do more, they cost more in some cases, and they become somewhat more necessary where as the years go on. So the $7.2 billion, like the rest of the stimulus package compared to the needs, is really kind of a tenth or a hundredth of what the marketplace or what the environment really needs. To put it in perspective, people are talking about the telecommunications infrastructure as the new railroads or the new roads. And the amount of money and the federal effort that went into first the railway system and then in the 1950s the interstate highway system, $7.2 billion would fix one or two states' worth, but it's not a solution on the national level. The idea, of course, it's going to be used in such a way that it helps other development happen like the rural electrification did, and so that there are productivity gains and there are also some equity gains in the process. But then, of course, the issue is, well, is the federal government, can it handle this? Is it capable? Is it competent to do this? And the two departments who are doing this are, as I said, the Department of Agriculture through the Rural Utility Service and the Department of Commerce through the National Telecommunications and Information Agency. And some of your listeners might get nervous when they hear those initials, NTIA. And the third agency, which sort of watches and manages all this, is the Federal Communications Commission. Why do your listeners get nervous when they hear FCC or NTIA? Because we've just gone through the digital broadcast transition, and those are the agencies that handled it. Good job, huh?
Well, speaking of that conversion, can you help explain why that took place and what the consequences will be?
Well, the main reason it took place was to reuse the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, the so-called airwaves over which this radio station is operating. And the spectrum was designated for use really back in the 1930s by the Federal Communications Commission. Some went to radio, then some went to TV, then later on some went to other wireless things like Citizens Band. And now, of course, the big glutton for wireless is cellular telephones. Well, there are more cellular telephone users and applications than there is airwaves. And the ability to switch from analog to digital for television and radio meant that more space could be freed up for other uses. So part of those uses go to public service and public safety uses. Police and fire, for example, have been asking for better radio spectrum for many, many years. Some of it's going to go to economic development of new and improved wireless services. So it's a efficiency thing, and the federal government then recaptures this resource and resells it again, in essence, for the benefit of the public and for the benefit of the businesses that use it. However, as any of us who've been watching the news over the last 6 months know, this transition has been botched badly by both the FCC and the NTIA, which got out there too late with too little and had coupons for people to get these converter boxes, and they ran out of coupon money and the money wasn't enough and the information didn't get out there quickly enough to the people who were really affected, and the people it didn't affect heard it too many times, and it became – there's a federal and military term for these kinds of things back from World War II.
FUBAR is one.
I was thinking SNAFU was the other. Yeah, I think most of your older listeners will know what those initials mean. SNAFU, for example, situation normal, all blanked up.
And fouled up, yes.
Fouled up is another good way to do it. And so this was a typical federal mess. The problem everybody knows with the federal government is it's too big. And it's a one-size-fits-all operation. So in general, if you set up a law or a rule, you've got to apply it equally in Arkansas and Alaska. And I hate to tell the federal government or anybody else, and everybody knows this, but Arkansas isn't the same as Alaska. And that can be held for most other states. I will maintain that Nebraska and Kansas are exactly the same, and North Dakota and South Dakota are exactly the same, but that's only because I don't live there. Mm-hmm. If I lived there, I'd know exactly how different they really are. So the federal government has to do things in a very big and very uniform way, and it's very difficult.
When you have such varied terrain and
political
situations.
Varied terrain, varied users. For example, just very quickly, here are the objectives of the money that the NTIA, the Department of Commerce, is giving out through its program. And again, it's giving out only 4.5 or so billion, but that's quite a bit of money, 4.7 billion. It's supposed to provide access to broadband for consumers in unserved areas, improve access for consumers in underserved areas, provide support for public interest schemes facilitating access to broadband, improve broadband uptake by public safety agencies, and stimulate demand for broadband and economic growth and job creation, because after all, it's the stimulus bill. Well, it's very hard to figure out which projects will do some of those things or all of those things and which ones are going to be better than others. But the federal government, through the NTIA, is going to have to give out the money to many more applicants for these grants than they have money for. Probably 3 or 4 or 5 times as many more. So they have to have criteria of which ones are better, which ones serve more people. And, of course, each one that comes from each particular area will be certainly endorsed by their member of Congress.
Oh, yes.
And their senators, and be important for their area. And like everything else, there will be a process, a political process, of dividing this up in some way. And that's tough to do on the federal level when you have a tenth of as much money as you need to do 4 times as many things as you really could do.
And how different is Wisconsin from other states? I mean, can you look at our state in terms of broadband issues? And how are we like Alaska? How are we like Texas? What do we have here that they don't? And what are some of our
idiosyncrasies? Well, we are like a lot of places in some ways. We have some real urban areas that are very like the most urban of any urban areas. So we have places that are very much like New York City and very much like Baltimore. But we also have some places that are, and I can think of them, and they're up north and they're small and they're rural, that are very much like Alaska. Because there's great distances between groups of populations, and there's some indigenous people in between them, and there are lots of animals and trees between all of them, but not many people. And so that makes it difficult to serve them with a wired solution very often because the economics are bad. So we're like, in some places, we're like the most rural states, and in some places we're like the most urban states. And so we have some significant amount of agriculture. The Department of Agriculture knows Wisconsin very well. And so you say, well, what makes the difference? How are they going to do this? And the answer is, like they do almost everything else, they'll figure out a way to make everybody unhappy in the same kinds of way, because nobody will get enough to have enough to really reach the goals they want, but no one will be ignored.
Well, that's very egalitarian. Maybe the ultimate solution, if there is such a thing, would have to do with technological improvements, so you wouldn't have to lay cable and you can just do everything from satellite
somehow.
And
that's starting to happen. But again, it's not as easy and it is not as fast and it's more expensive. It's the rural solution certainly to getting video to people in rural areas. They put up a satellite dish, they pay the provider, and they can watch the same HBO show as I watch on my wired cable. But that system is not as good for broadband two-way. Can send me internet okay, but it's not so great at getting me a signal back from me in a robust way. Used to be that didn't matter. Most of the internet originally, like cable, was kind of a one-way medium. You turned it on, you looked at things.
You're right.
Not anymore.
It's got to be interactive.
People are playing games over it. People are showing their little movies and sending them out to the world over it. And so you really look for the ability to have a robust two-way pipeline to the urban household and to the rural household, as well as the rural farm, the urban information factory in somebody's basement, or, and most important, I think, the schools, the fire stations.
Aren't we ending up with a sort of graveyard of old technologies? I mean,
you see my basement?
Well, I'm not talking about just within the house where, yes, we have all these, you know, rejected phones or computer things, but in terms of various kinds of cables and wires and things that have been out there and are no longer being used.
Well, some are and some aren't. AT&T is developing its broadband model on its old copper wires. And so it might bring fiber optic high capacity wire to your neighborhood, but it'll connect it to a converter package that uses the same simple copper wire phone line buried in your backyard and in your neighborhood. And they're squeezing a lot of information by digitalizing it into that little old copper wire. The cable company has a somewhat wider, bigger pipe into your home, a coaxial cable. And some companies, for example, Verizon, has taken the opposite approach, and they're building a fiber, very big capacity pipe, right into connecting to your home itself. It's called fiber to the home or fiber to the premises. That's much more expensive. They think it's going to be better in the long run because they'll have bigger capacity. AT&T has taken the position, our little wire is enough because we have enough technological ways to squeeze things into that little wire. But they're also admitting that that little wire is going to have to be replaced sooner or later by a bigger wire. So, yes, there are a lot of old technologies, old wires, old receivers, old phones, old use of the spectrum that get junked. And as we get better and technology improves, we throw those away very often.
What do you see happening 10 years from now?
Well, I am kind of an old-fashioned guy. I always thought that nobody would really want VCRs because it was
all
kind of specialized.
You're right.
But I'm talking 25 years ago. I didn't think the cell phones were going to catch on. I thought that cell phones with video were silly. So I may be the wrong person to ask because anything I think is a silly, ridiculous, and unnecessary technology has been adapted by America very quickly. So it's hard for me to predict. Anybody who can predict can get pretty rich pretty quickly. The prediction is the things that you can, I think, bank on are these. We'll need more pipeline pretty much going into the future as far as we can see because the technologies are converging and they are using one another's platforms. There will be new industries that we couldn't imagine yet, and it will all be done from your home or your office computer or your workplace station or whatever they're going to call it. I think it's clear that the large telephone companies have enough money to survive in this market going forward. The cable companies have done – the big ones have done pretty well. But the one thing you can look at over time and say this has been a current trend is little companies get swallowed by bigger companies, big companies get swallowed by mega companies, and companies try to buy out or take their competitors over in such a way that they control things. So that's you have the tendency towards monopoly.
Well, yeah. Which is a pretty standard business model anyway, whether you're talking cable companies or dairy farms.
Yeah, you get fewer individual competitors, larger agglomerations of companies or organizations, and they try to compete across lines of business. So you might someday see in 10 years the AT&T, Time Warner, Microsoft Corporation or something like that.
No antitrust suit in sight.
The last time we tried antitrust, we tried it with AT&T, and they divested. And in 20 years, they recombined again so that there's one large company again that had most of the pieces that we took out of it. The other thing we tried to do, which we tried to break up IBM, we settled that suit. That never went to court. And then we took on Microsoft and lost pretty much. So you see companies try to control all these things. And sometimes there's some spectacular failures as a result. If you remember the combination of Time Warner and AOL.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where essentially AOL took over Time Warner. And very recently, Time Warner has jettisoned AOL as something it doesn't need anymore. It was embarrassed to be connected to because people thought AOL was the future. Well, it turned out AOL was kind of this giant Ponzi scheme. And they had more people wanted to get onto it than they had ability to deal with for many years. And then they were a dial-up organization that got bypassed by the technology in seemingly a year or two. And so you really can't – it's hard to predict these kinds of things. But young people like technology and they are very, very used to it. Us older people who sort of are slow adapters are dying out. And in truth, you know, my parents have a cell phone they only use for emergencies. They've got cable. They don't have a computer. They don't want internet. They have nothing to do with it. I can't imagine not having internet, but I don't have a BlackBerry. I don't want internet on my telephone. It looks cute, but I don't want like those little tiny little buttons. And I can't type with two fingers while I drive. But apparently the 18-year-olds can do that very well.
Well, we'll see if we can get some insight into where this might be headed in the next few years, this conglomeration and overlapping of technologies and communication. When we return in a moment, this is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. For the next few minutes, we're with Barry Orton, who is giving us some insight into this rapidly expanding and overlapping world of cable and broadband, which includes telephone and also internet. And tell me what I'm leaving out.
Satellite.
Thank you. Well, getting back to this whole question of equity, as this technology continues to expand and as the business enterprises continue to morph, we have this question about who is more likely to get served, even if the government is providing their billions of dollars. We still have this donut in the cities, in the urban areas, which
right.
are considered unprofitable
right.
by the company. So
hole in the donut anyway is considered
right,
unprofitable.
That's right. They want to work around those unprofitable areas in the urban environment. And then you have the vast rural areas, lots of space, people spread out fairly thinly who also want service.
Right.
Who is likely to get it, do you think?
Well, I think the urban folks are in better shape technically because the wire is closer and the infrastructure runs under the streets or next to their houses. So there's not that huge investment in getting the wire to their home. It's a matter of feet rather than miles. But certainly the rural areas of this country, rural Nevada, rural Alaska, rural California, all the places where their people are really spread out and they're spread out beyond just farms, the ranches of Montana, for example, that's an enormous expense to bring that broadband system in the same robust way. So you have wireless alternatives. You have the satellite alternative. And that's a reasonable alternative for video. It's a reasonable alternative for telephone. As I said, it's the tough part of that is kind of the uplink of getting lots of information back from the ranch into the system. But I think we're going to be doing that again because our political system is such that it kind of demands that. That equity is kind of a fundamental equity. And so you have all these formulas that get worked out state by state and sometimes within states, area by area. So federal dollars, federal programs do reach those people. And again, that's a fundamental political issue that we have in this country. And I think since the New Deal and the Rural Electrification Act, we've really said as a country that rural citizens and urban citizens shouldn't be second class with fundamental infrastructure issues. And I think that's going to really play out in the Obama administration because the Obama campaign depended so much on these new technologies. If you remember, they raised an awful lot of money, particularly early on, through the internet, through cell phone use. They organized the campaign through the internet, through cell phone use, through new technology. They reached people who hadn't ever really participated in the political process before, and they reached them through their new technologies. They reached them through the cell phones. They reached them through the internet. They reached them through mass emailing. And they're continuing to do this outreach today, even while they're in office.
Right.
They have maintained a political arm that's doing this pretty much continuously. So I believe they have an enormous sensitivity to the people who do depend on these technologies because that was the constituency that got them there.
I've heard it tied into healthcare reform as well, that if you have rural areas and if they've got that internet access, they can be linked in terms of medical.
Well, some of the fundamental savings that the administration thinks it's going to get out of healthcare reform revolve around the efficiencies afforded by new technologies. They revolve around things like making medical records completely computerized and available to anyone, anywhere, which lets you switch doctors more easily, which lets the doctors cooperate in some ways more easily, which allows it supposedly anyway takes a lot of the slippage out of the billing and the medical provision system so that which has depended on paper records, had depended on individual systems very different, and so that there are some efficiencies there that really the healthcare reform is depending on. So I think that's not going away, and that absolutely depends on the connectivity that those rural areas depend on. Good example in Wisconsin is up north. The Marshfield Clinic is one of the most computerized small and medium-sized medical operations in the country, and it did its medical records very early, and now it is connected to places like Mayo, and it is connected via what's called telemedicine. And so you can get your X-ray or your CAT scan on site, and the person who's reading it isn't the person who's picking the actual physical X-ray out of the bin or in that clinic at all. It might be the person who's reading it in a satellite clinic somewhere or even in another state or in another country. So those things, I think, are really definitely fundamentally connected.
What other applications can you see besides in medicine where if we do provide more equitable connections and the entire country is more wired, what else could you see happening?
Well, I think going back to the fundamental economy of rural areas, I think that farmers and food producers and producers of other agricultural goods are really going to be benefiting from both the technological efficiencies available by computerized systems and the efficiencies of the marketplace, whereby they can bid for business outside their immediate area or outside their immediate marketplace. So there is some great leveling that goes on with that. But again, they've got to have access to it on a kind of an equitable basis.
Is that the kind of thing you think can happen if we have a number of companies vying for business? Or is it more likely to happen if we have one or two big ones?
Well, I always favor smaller, more numerous competitors, but that's not the way things go in these industries. And when the competitors get big enough, that's when you need the public service commissions of the states and when you need the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission on the federal level to say, this is too big. This is where we draw the line. It might be two cable companies versus eight. It might be four phone companies versus 18. It might be one or two broadband companies versus 20. But somewhere that line really needs to be drawn. And we've really hesitated about drawing that line really since the IBM case, which was in the Reagan administration. Ever since then, the Federal Communications Commission, Federal Trade Commission, Department of Justice have really backed off on saying this is too big. This is an antitrust problem. And they've played around on the margins of things, but they really haven't attacked the big issues. And I think that's going to be a huge political issue in the next few years for this administration.
And what if you're a consumer and you're about to choose a bundle or a package or a this or a that and you're confused? Any resource for you?
Well, the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection in this state does have a fairly good website that lists some of your issues. They don't tell you company by company. They will tell you if you ask or you look around how many complaints they have versus each company. Remember I mentioned how they count complaints. So that's one way that you can tell. But the real classic thing is always the same. You've got to read the fine print in detail and ask questions. What does this mean before you sign it? And then there's a guy who just retired from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection who has been the watchdog of consumer protection in this state for many years. And his best watchword is buy local. Go to a local company you trust or at least has a local office that you can go to. The more local, the more you have some access to those people and they're more accountable. And that's kind of a rule of thumb with a lot of things, but it's hard to do that when your choices are between Time Warner and AT&T.
Our guest has been Barry Orton with a very illuminating hour having to do with broadband and how its purveyors compete for your dollar. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.